The Atlanta Jewish Film Festival has partnered with Out On Film for a special screening of The Lavender Scare. That documentary is the first to detail the 1950s campaign by the United States government to identify and fire all employees suspected of being homosexual. We have the film's director, Josh Howard, here in studio with us, along with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival's Chris Holland and Out On Film's Jim Farmer. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Josh, this is a very impressive and most disturbing documentary, and you worked on it for a very long time. What led you to create it?
Well, I stumbled upon a book called The Lavender Scare. I had thought I knew about American history, about the McCarthy era, but I just happened to come across this book that told the story of the government's systematic effort that began in the 1950s and continued for decades to identify and remove gay men and lesbians from the federal workforce. And it was just a fascinating story. And the characters who were described in the book were getting on in years, and I just wanted to preserve their stories on film.
And we should add, Josh's background is most impressive. I have to say it because he won't. He has 24 Emmy Awards to his credit. This man knows something about producing and filmmaking. And I wondered why this was the first documentary on the Lavender Scare. Why do you think it hadn't been explored on film before?
Well, it was also the first book written about the Lavender Scare. Terrific historian David Johnson began work in the 1990s on this subject. It's a story that has never been told because while it was going on, there was really a conspiracy of silence on both sides. The gay men and lesbians who were being fired didn't want to talk about why they were driven out of their jobs because they were indeed in the closet and they wanted to keep their sexuality a secret because they, you know, needed other jobs and homosexuality was not accepted in the 1950s. So they didn't talk about why they were fired, and the government, after an initial burst of publicity, as this systematic effort went on for really several decades, the government didn't want to talk about how many people were getting fired, because the question would then be, well, why did you hire them in the first place? So neither side really discussed this, and it's not until David Johnson started his research. A lot of government documents had been newly declassified in the 1990s. He was the first person to actually put together the overall picture of how the government systematically went about this.
One of the facts brought out in the film very effectively is that before the Lavender Scare, before the early 50s, it seems that openly gay people in the 1920s and 30s were at least discriminated against less, if not more, accepted by society. What was happening then?
Well, I think that's such an interesting message of the film, that really the homophobia and discrimination of the 1950s was a direct backlash against that earlier time when homosexuality was more accepted by society. You know, there was the Great Depression in the 30s and World War II in the 40s, and people were more focused on more practical issues of living their lives than worrying about how other people were living theirs. And it was really in the 1950s that there was a conservative backlash against that.
And before that conservative backlash in the early 50s, World War II broke out. What impact did that have on gay life? Jim?
Well,
Josh?
Absolutely. It was one of the historians in the film describes World War II as the most revolutionary thing that happened to gay men and lesbians. And the reason was that with the draft and people volunteering to serve, millions of Americans were mobilized, and those who did enlist found themselves in same-sex environments and were able to, in many cases, connect with other gay people for the first time in their lives. They'd come from small towns where, you know, they were isolated, might have thought they were the only gay people, but being in the service gave them that opportunity. It also created an influx of people into metropolitan areas and created the opportunity to build gay communities in that way.
I mean, that part of it was very heartening. Here, people just trying to serve their countries dutifully and then also discovering others like themselves and minding their own business when they're not working.
Well, during World War II, the government needed bodies, and the military did not go out of its way to, throw out gay men and lesbians. They wanted people to fight. It was only after the war that the government and the military then began to weed out homosexuals with a vengeance. Mm.
Out on Film kicks off in 2 weeks, and the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival doesn't begin until the winter of 2018. Why have these occasional programs, such as this screening of The Lavender Scare? What does this do for a festival?
5 years ago, Out on Film started year-round programming, and we've been pretty aggressive about it this year. And I know that the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival has recently started as well. I know for us, it allows us to really show films throughout the year versus, an eight-day period. And it's a great way to keep your name out there and show films like this that might not have been available during the time of your festival. Mm-hmm. So I love being able to show films like this and to be able to collaborate with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival is wonderful. It's a wonderful opportunity. Collaborating with other arts organizations in town really gives you an opportunity to bring your audience and their audience together, and nothing really brings community together as art does. It's a great opportunity.
Yeah, we're following Jim's lead with the year-round programming, just starting that this year. And I think every so often you strike on a film like this one that the Venn diagram of the audience that's interested overlaps so much that it's a natural fit. Mm-hmm. And, we're extremely grateful for the support that our base has shown to us and has shown to this film. And there's a segment of our base that is, also Jim's base. And we want those people to come out. We want more people in our base who aren't in that camp to see more about Out on Film and, to be aware that it's there. And just as the Jewish Film Festival welcomes everyone, it's, their films, not just Jewish films, they're for everybody. Sometimes our audience needs to be reminded that the same is true of Out on Film. Mm-hmm. They're not just gay and lesbian films, they're awesome films.
Exactly. This is a perfect film to collaborate on. I mean, I really think this is a perfect collaboration this time around.
If you are just joining us, I'm speaking with The Lavender Scare director Josh Howard, along with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival's Chris Holland and Jim Farmer of Out on Film. We'll be back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from Theater Emory, presenting Midnight Pillow, inspired by Mary Shelley, directed by Park Crowson, September 21st through October 1st in the Schwartz Center Theater Lab. What dreams haunt your Midnight Pillow? Info at theater.emory.edu. And from Reliable Heating and Air, a Train dealer, a family company since 1978, offering heating and air, plumbing, electrical, and duct cleaning 24 hours a day. Learn more at reliableair.com.
You are listening to City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us. I'm here with filmmaker Josh Howard and film festival organizers Chris Holland of the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival and Jim Farmer of Out on Film. The AJFF and Out on Film are presenting Josh's documentary, The Lavender Scare, tonight at Midtown Arts Cinema. It didn't take long after this golden period of World War II for reactionary views to take hold, fomented by Senator Joe McCarthy's work. The campaign was beyond ruthless. I mean, it destroyed lives. It ended some lives. And one aspect of the film that I found especially haunting is the use of interviews with people who carried out these horrible attacks. FBI agents, State Department officers. And the use of language was so startling. Perverts is the acceptable term. I mean, it, in newspapers, perverts, I guess this all just reinforces how grateful I feel to have been born when I was born. Not that things are so great now, but so this language, these horrid attacks were on people mostly who were dutifully serving their country. And then there were the appeals to their co-workers and friends to do their patriotic duty, which seems harder for us to grasp now than I guess it must have felt as a moral dilemma for them at the time. But how did the government connect the dots, if you will, from one's sexual orientation to being a threat to national security? I mean, it's almost laughable.
Well, there was never any real evidence, but the theory was that gay people were in the closet and wanted to hide their sexuality, and that would make them susceptible to blackmail by foreign government agents. The first part of that was actually true. Gay people did need to remain in the closet. Intimate acts between same-sex couples were illegal throughout the country in those days. And so there was a very practical reason homosexuals didn't want to disclose their sexuality. So the government was right about that. The second part never happened. There was never a single case that the government could identify of a gay man or lesbian being blackmailed by a foreign government into revealing secrets. The irony of the story is that they were being blackmailed, however, by their own government, because government agents would say to gay people who they had identified, give us the names of other gay people who you know so we can go investigate them. And if you don't give us those names, then we're going to expose you. And so a lot of people, you know, some refused and stayed silent, but a lot of people did submit to that pressure to reveal the names of other people.
Please tell us about Frank Kameny.
Frank Kameny was, he's one of a kind. probably 5,000 people had been fired by the government and had gone quietly without any protest before Frank Kameny came along. He was the first person to fight back and resist his firing. He was born in New York. He was educated at Harvard University. He had a PhD in astronomy. This was in the early days of the space age, when very few people were as well trained in that field as he was. And he was stubborn, and he believed that he was right. And he fought his dismissal, and he fought it through administrative channels, through the courts. He wrote his own brief to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was turned down every step of the way. And at some point, he decided that political activism was the way to make some progress in this area. And he really is now seen as the first person to really radicalize the gay rights movement years before Stonewall.
Yeah, and tell us how he went about it.
Well, Frank was responsible for organizing the first gay rights pickets in the country, and it happened at the White House, and it was just his personality and determination that attracted other people, and it's kind of the silver lining in a way to this story, that it was the discrimination and oppression of the government actions that really created this spark within the gay community that launched the early days of the gay rights movement.
But what he experienced was soul-crushing. I mean, would it have been soul-crushing for others, and was, but it just seemed to motivate him all the more in terms of getting this before the courts. And I think, I don't think this is a spoiler alert. It's one of the great moments of the film. When President Obama recognizes him in 2009 for his work on behalf of civil rights.
Well, it was a remarkable moment for Frank, and so symbolic for the movement. Here was a guy who was thrown out of the government because he was gay, and now, you know, he's being honored by the president. But, you know, you mentioned it could be a soul-crushing moment. Frank's soul could never be crushed, and it really took someone like this to be the first person to fight back. Frank was fond of saying that if he and society disagreed on an issue, he would give that issue careful second thought. He would consider society's opinion. And after that second thought, if he still felt he was right, then in fact he was right and society was wrong. And they better stay out of his way because he's going to fight for what he believed was right. And he certainly did that.
Speaking of, the true scientific method, or who knows, philosophical method that he wrote, it was interesting to me that in organizing that first picket line outside the White House, that he required those marching to adhere to a dress code. This was not a radical. This was not someone throwing bombs. This was someone who said, if you want to look like you're employable, then dress as though you're employable, according to their standards.
Well, he was a combination of both. It took a radical to pick it at that point and to come out as a gay man, but he also understood what the goal was, and he also was pretty strict about things, and he would not let people picket with him unless they were dressed appropriately. As the movement progressed beyond Stonewall into the 1970s, he went from being seen as a radical to, by some people, seen as being too conservative, mm-hmm. because he still was wearing suits and ties. But he continued fighting for gay rights throughout the rest of his life.
Josh, with the FBI involvement, I wondered whether you had considered including anything in the film about J. Edgar Hoover or Roy Cohn, because these names didn't appear, did they?
We did consider it. Really felt that it's an interesting sidelight to the story, and David Johnson in his book explores that relationship. But in terms of the film, we really wanted to focus on certainly the people who were fired, but also the government officials who were directly responsible for carrying out the investigations and the firings.
I must mention that the film is a documentary, but it builds with such suspense that it feels a lot like a thriller. I mean, I kept hoping I was going to get through this gruesome chapter to a better ending. And the music is so effective. Would you talk about some of the other elements in the documentary, like the photos and the use? The editing is marvelous.
Well, it was a hard story to make into a film because there was very little newsreel footage of these actual events. So we worked very hard at gathering documents, still photos. We used some sketches at some point. Had a very talented editor and motion design artist, Bruce Shaw, who took these elements and I think was able to visualize the story in a way that's engaging to the audience.
Oh, and the music, it's marvelous, but it's so menacing. I mean, Hitchcock, you know, Bernard Herrmann, it's just marvelous. We have been speaking with the director of the documentary, The Lavender Scare, Josh Howard, along with the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival's Chris Holland, and Out on Films, Jim Farmer. The film will be screened tonight at 7 o'clock at Midtown Art Cinema. Josh, congratulations. And
thank
gentlemen,
you so much.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.